A political newcomer is the challenger in a closely watched race in Atlantic Beach. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening on this Wednesday. I'm Melissa Ross. We're always live on the radio at 9, and now just subscribe to our daily podcast, too, on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, candidate John Stinson takes your calls about his big priorities out at the beaches. We're already getting your calls. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, helping First Coast farmers ply their trade, we'll tell you about a special event in today's Going Green. Plus, New York Times bestselling author Andrew Moranis on his fascinating look at race and college sports in the South. Strong inside, all of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, he's taking on incumbent Maria Mark in a closely watched race out in Atlantic Beach. Businessman John Stinson will appear at a candidate forum later this afternoon out at Fleet Landing. He says he's running for the Seat 2 Commission post to improve the quality of life in Atlantic Beach in a number of areas. And he joins us now with more about his campaign. John Stinson, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Melissa, and thanks to First Coast Connect and WJCT. I'm glad to be here.
We're glad to host you, and we're already getting calls for John Stinson, a political newcomer running for office in Atlantic Beach. Yes, there is an election happening this month in our area, so get on the line now with your questions and comments at 549-2937. That's 549-2937, or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. We're already getting your comments, by the way, on Facebook. If that's easiest for you, you can way in there. And so you came to the beaches about 4 years ago from Texas. You had become familiar with the area through business, and you've gotten involved in the community. What prompted your run for office?
Well, I chose to run for office because during the HRO debate, I heard the comment was made that some things are too important to let the voters decide. My upbringing in a small town in southeast New Mexico, I was always taught that my vote was important and it mattered.
And you decided to run for the Seat 2 Commission post. You're facing incumbent Maria Mark. She is known, of course, for leading the way on passage of the human rights ordinance in Atlantic Beach. That's not your leading issue, though, is it?
No, I'm not campaigning on that. That ordinance has been addressed by the city. I think that we have other issues that need to be addressed.
And so what are your big concerns when it comes to quality of life and problems out at the beaches?
Sure. I think there's first and foremost is our city is ill-prepared to handle emergencies. Our emergency management plan considers hurricanes, but not any of the other types of emergencies or issues that they might need to deal with. I think the Mayport corridor needs to be addressed. This Mayport CRA is a great first step, but we need to get businesses more involved. I think our city needs to find a way to support our schools and education system. And crime and safety, I think we've had some crime issues because of the development things that are going on in our community that need to be addressed as well.
All righty. And let's talk a little bit about the Mayport corridor. That has been certainly a big concern for people in your area. Your opponent the other day on this program said that Mayport Road is sort of like the proverbial railroad tracks. There's one side of the tracks and the other side. Do you agree? And how would you approach this whole issue of how to develop that area?
Sure. I don't know that I would agree that Mayport divides our city in half like that. But I think the Mayport CRA and making it where we can use tax dollars to reinvest in that part of the community is great. But what I would like to do is have an industrial development council of local businesses and nearby neighbors that sit down and let them decide, you know, what they need to improve that area instead of it being a top-down from the elected officials approach.
And we'll go to your calls for Atlantic Beach political newcomer John Stinson in a moment. Let us know your questions and comments at 549-2937. Now, you talked about the need for a comprehensive plan for hurricanes out at the beaches. The city of Jacksonville does have a plan, but how do you see the beaches communities working with downtown when it comes to that? And in the past years, there's been tension off and on between problems with the interlocal agreement, how the beaches communities and the city of Jacksonville work together. What are your thoughts about all of that?
Well, with regards to the emergency management plan, you're right. Jacksonville has a plan, and it seems to be very well defined. And I can pick up the Jacksonville plan and figure out what to do if I'm in Jacksonville. What you can't find out is what we're going to do if there's an emergency in Atlantic Beach that prevents us from getting off the island and into the Jacksonville system and where Jacksonville is navigating us in and out of the emergency. We don't have that. And the plan also puts people, we have a very good city manager, but he does not have the training to be an incident commander in an emergency like that. And we need to make sure that we train people before we put them in a position where they can't perform up to our expectations.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to the environment, that's something you're also campaigning about, preserving the natural beauty of the beaches. What do you see as the biggest challenges in that region?
Sure. So you have to understand, I grew up in a place, southeast New Mexico, lots of beach sand, no water. I'm really concerned about the dredging of the ship channel. I don't know that when we do things like that, that there is no impact. And the dredging of the ship channel issue, you know, the comments made by the Corps of Engineers that they will monitor that after they do the work. Well, once you've done the work, it's a little bit late to you're not going to turn back the clock and fix that. So I think that's an issue. I have some concerns about us building these pathways and piers and walkways out through the marsh. I think the marsh needs to be pristine, and we need to find other ways for people to enjoy them. So I think, and you just have to be good stewards of the resource.
And so are you opposed to the dredging of the shipping channel down to a depth of 47 feet to accommodate for those Panamax-ready ships?
At the present time, I am, yes. Because, I haven't had the question answered as to what makes us think those ships are coming here. No one's been able to answer that question for me. I think the impact of that, we have some real concerns about what's it going to do to the marsh, what's it going to do to the wildlife that lives there. I'm really concerned about it.
Now, in any race, most of the time, the person who's the incumbent holds an advantage. You're mm-hmm. taking on a well-known incumbent, Maria Mark. Why should the voters consider you for this post over her?
Wow. So why should they consider me instead of Ms. Mark? So, one, I'm committed to so it's a difference in philosophy. So most politicians, when they're elected, they assume office. And then they take that as a mandate to go and pursue their agendas and their ideals and their goals. Well, I don't believe that. I believe when you are elected to office, you just took a job. And if I'm elected to office in Atlantic Beach, I have 13,000 or so supervisors, bosses, if you will, that are going to tell me which direction they want me to help take the city. It's not my agenda. It's theirs.
And let's go to your calls right now for John Stinson, the newcomer seeking office in Atlantic Beach. What are your questions? What are your comments? 549-2937. Let's go to Susan in Atlantic Beach to begin things off. Hey, Susan, good morning. How are you today?
I am great. How are you?
Doing well, thanks.
Am I ready to talk?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Yes, John, I had a question for you. Intrigued by your slogan, your voice, your choice, and also on your website, you said being an elected official does not mean you have the right to decide what is best for others. You get to make choices. You're inferring Atlantic Beach gets to make choices for yourself. After all, it's your voice, your choice. So in that case, it sounds to me like you're alluding to the Human Rights Ordinance that was passed by the commissioners, and that was a very emotional question. And we have another emotional item coming up, and that's the Gate Station. And I wondered if you're going to put that to vote then for all of Atlantic Beach citizens, because there are some that are very concerned about a big box Gate Station coming in and others who want the business. So will that go for a vote under you as a commissioner?
And Susan, where is this slated to go in?
It is going to be right on Atlantic Boulevard next to the Beaches Diner, which is an icon and a favorite diner of all locals.
All righty. Yeah, that's Susan out at the Beaches. Thanks for the call, Susan. John.
Sure. Thank you, Susan. So, yes, the Gate Petroleum Beach Diner issue is a big issue for Atlantic Beach. I don't know anyone that lives in our beach community or one of our neighboring communities that doesn't like to go to a beach diner. I think this issue, unfortunately, the city has somewhat inserted itself in an issue between two businesses. And we did that by issuing an opinion to Gate Petroleum. And the problem is that I have with the whole issue is when we start giving variances or concessions to one business to the detriment of another, I don't. That's one of the reasons that we're seen as a business-unfriendly environment. So to answer your question, I think this has to play out between Beach Diner and Gate Petroleum, and the city is going to have to figure out how they extract themselves out of this, because the way it should work is the two businesses decide. Our opinion should have been to Gate Petroleum is our ordinances and our rules and our laws are posted on our website. Go figure out how those apply to you and make your permit. But we're not going to tell you that, yes, you can do something that's outside of those ordinances. We did that, and how we get ourselves out of that is a very difficult question.
And we'll go to your tweets, emails, Facebook comments for Atlantic Beach Commission candidate John Stinson in just a moment. Lots of them coming in, but right now the number to join the show, 549-2937. Susan, also in Atlanta, another Susan in Atlantic Beach. Mm-hmm. Hi, Susan. Good morning.
Hi. There's a bunch of us here.
I guess so.
Okay. Mr. Stinson, my question is in reference to your treasurer report as of July 24th, that indicate you have personally loaned your campaign almost $20,000. And I am curious as to why you feel the need to loan your campaign so much money when most candidates raise $10,000 or less.
Sure. So that's a good question, and it's an easy answer. One, we spent a significant amount of money trying to increase the voter turnout come August 25th. I think 30% turnout is very, very poor, and our hope was to get a voter turnout in the 40 to 50% range. That's one thing we did, and that cost us some significant dollars. We also did something a couple other things that none of the other candidates have done to date that I'm aware of. We published a lot of our campaign materials in Spanish, trying to reach the Spanish-speaking population, trying to get them to come out and vote. And last, we have hosted 5 of 6 town halls across the city that increased our costs. And the whole purpose of that was to hear your voice and your choice so that if I'm elected, I know what you want me to do.
And that's where those funds went.
That's where
those endeavors.
Those endeavors. And the fact that we also had to create a website, you know, from scratch and hired a pretty good marketing firm to do that. And that's not cheap.
And by the way, on your website, there's a photo of you with your signature look. Let's talk about it for people that don't know what you look like, because this is radio. You're known for your black, is it a 10-gallon Stetson hat?
The one that I wear in the summer is made by Larry Mahan, but in the winter, it's a Stetson hat, not necessarily 10-gallon.
Right, but you come from Texas, so that's a Texas look that you brought to the beaches.
Correct.
What kind of comments do you get about it, usually?
Oh, when I'm in my swim trunks and my guard and my cowboy hat, I get a few looks at the beach that are like strange. But, you know, most people have come to recognize, and I get a lot of people that come up to me and they're like, hey, you're John Stinson. I'm like, yes, I am.
All right.
So they recognize it.
They know you for it. And we have a lot of tweets coming in for candidate John Stinson. Here's one from the St. John's River Ferry. How will John Stinson help support the ferry?
Awesome. That's a very good question, because I ride that ferry probably 3 times a week to my job in Fernandina. We just did this past Saturday. We handed out water bottles for the Mellow Mushroom bike ride that went to the ferry to raise awareness. I think that we have to continue to get people to think about the ferry. How we lost $1 million in funding from Tallahassee is beyond me. It's a state highway, and we've got all this energy over the East Coast Greenway that's, you know, headed towards the ferry. And what are we going to do if the ferry's not there? I think we have to work to preserve that ferry. I think it's very important to our community and to Jacksonville in general.
How would you use your position to secure funding for the ferry if you're elected?
Well, that's a very good question. I think that comes down to, you know, working with our representatives that go to Tallahassee, because they're the ones that make those decisions, and also the ones that go to Washington, because that funding's got to come from somewhere.
Mm-hmm. And to be sure, the Duval delegation, you know, they lobbied for the ferry.
Absolutely.
But they were they lost that fight. The mm-hmm. governor exercised his line item veto power, mm-hmm. and the ferries just had been dancing on the edge of that issue in terms of secure funding for many years. Do you see that as a critical link for your region, keeping that ferry operational?
Sure, sure. I think it's very critical. It's very important to me because, again, I travel to Fernandina for work, and I think there are a lot of people that make that drive back and forth on a regular basis. At the ferry, you know, you see people that are just taking the ferry across the river and working not far across there. I think it's very important. I think we have to work very, very hard to keep that going. And you're right. It has been on the bubble ever since I've been in Jacksonville.
And here's a follow-up tweet from the earlier caller about the gate station. He didn't answer the question. Jimmy tweets the show, would John Stinson put the gate station issue to a public vote?
I don't know how you do that. I don't know how I don't know how you put that on a ballot, because it's an issue between two businesses that's going to play out in court, and where Atlantic Beach lands after that decision is made between those two businesses is out of our hands. I don't know how you do that.
Here's a tweet from another listener. Are the beaches working on contingency plans for sea level rise like other coastal communities around Florida? In particular, in South Florida, local elected officials have really taken the lead on that because they're already being affected by sea level rise. It's less of a threat in northern Florida, but it's certainly a concern. How do you see that issue affecting Atlantic Beach, and what would you do about it?
Well, sea level rise, of course, is a concern for anyone close to the coast. Everyone in Atlantic Beach lives 10 to 15 feet above sea level, and none of us want to step out on our front porch and see the water washing up against our homes. I'm not sure what contingencies Atlantic Beach can take to address that. We just need to be cognizant of what the academic community is doing and what their findings are.
Well, for example, in Miami-Dade, Broward counties, they've already begun, the local elected officials on the councils or commissions or whatever they're called in that part of the state, they've already begun enacting aggressive mitigation plans. They're already being affected by flooding. And is that something that you would consider legislation on?
Well, I think we have to consider it. I mean, our job as a commissioner is to provide for the safety of our community, and you certainly have to consider what you could do. I'm just not sure that we have an answer for that.
Here's a comment on our Facebook page from Doug. Does John Stinson support fees charged to developers to pay for infrastructure in new developments?
Sure. I think there are impact fees that are assessed to developers when you do any kind of development. I don't know that it applies for, you know, single family residence type development, but I think, I know as a business that if you do anything that creates an increase in the impact or the traffic on roads and right-of-ways, that there are fees that are in place for that.
And here's an email from Jeannie. Why are you opposed to Atlantic Beach creating a seaside council? We have four great Jacksonville colleges and universities who have studied coastal and river life. Why would you oppose receiving input from the latest studies so we can use this information as we move forward with our community planning?
Sure. Good question, and not that the those aren't big issues, but I think the academic community is going to do their work with or without Atlantic Beach. Second, I think Atlantic Beach has a lot more locally focused things that we need to work on. We have a pension plan that in another 5 years would risk the financial stability of the community. We have this police building that just suffered a $400,000 increase in cost that needs to be addressed. And for us, it's like any business. If you aren't focused on what you can affect and what you can influence, then you're not going to, if you're focused on other things, then you're not going to be taking care of the things that you should be.
And more calls coming in for John Stinson at 549-2937. Julie at the beaches. Hi, Julie. Go ahead. Good morning.
Good morning. I have two questions for Mr. Stinson that I can take off the air. The first one is, does Mr. Stinson support the gay rights ordinance as it stands in Atlantic Beach? And the second question is, I live in Atlantic Beach, and I haven't heard of any town hall meetings that Mr. Stinson has been involved in. So when and where were these town hall meetings? And thank you for taking my call. I'll listen on the air.
All right. Thanks, Julie.
Thanks, Julie. So I'm going to answer your second question first. So the six town hall meetings that the five of six that I've hosted have been in the various community centers, Gail Baker Center, Jordan Center, and Adele Graves. Our final town hall will be the 22nd of August at Adele Graves from 9:30 to 11:30. The calendar on my website, voteforjohnstinson.com, you can find all of that information. Now, as to the HRO, I'm not really in favor of the HRO as written. First, it puts our city manager in a position of reviewing claims and cases, and we don't have a judicial system in place to handle those things. And Mr. Van Leer is a very capable city manager, but he's not trained for that. Second, I also think it puts some of our businesses at risk. I think it was just poorly written and poorly implemented. Now, let me qualify that with would not abide by discrimination, and I don't think most people in Atlantic Beach, I'm not going to be so naive as to say no one in Atlantic Beach would do that kind of thing. But I think the other part of the rule is why couldn't we write that a little bit more broad to cover a whole host of people?
Such as?
American Indians. I've got American Indian heritage in me, and if someone perceives me as being an American Indian and they don't want to rent me a spot, I think there's a way to do that it covers anyone. It doesn't matter what your race or your religion or your lifestyle is. I think the rule could have been written to cover anyone, that we're not going to discriminate against anyone for anything in these areas.
Did Atlantic Beach have a human rights ordinance that covered certain protected classes before the passage of this measure covering the LGBT community?
Atlantic Beach did not, but it's my belief that we have federal and state laws that did cover those things. But again, Atlantic Beach, no, did not have that.
So the human rights ordinance passed in 2014 in Atlantic Beach covers race, religion, gender, disability, sexual orientation. Those are typically, you know, the groups covered in language.
Correct.
For these ordinances.
Correct.
Okay. Let's take a few more calls. Let's go to Mark on the South Side. Go ahead, Mark.
Hi, yeah. I just wanted to ask the congressman, basically what I'm hearing from you is that, you know, people's civil rights are up for a public vote, but when it comes to a business, they're beyond reproach. You know, we have no say in a business, but when it comes to our civil rights, go ahead, vote on it.
No, that's, I'm sorry that if that was, if that's how you perceive my answer, no, that's not my response. I think your voice is important no matter what. Yep, you ought to be able to vote on civil rights issues. That was a very divisive issue for our community. Our commission spent a year on it, and I think you should have been able to vote on it, just like citizens get to vote on our charter amendments. The issue with Gate Petroleum and Beach Diner is, how are we going to put that to a vote? Are we going to send that out to the citizens and say what? Because our ordinances are our ordinances, and it says Gate can do particular things on the property they own, and Beach Diner can do particular things on their property. But we've inserted ourselves in the middle of that, and I'd be open to the question. How do you put that to the citizens to a vote? I would love to hear the answer to that.
Meanwhile, your opponent in this race, Maria Mark, commenting on our Facebook
Sure.
page, saying this is wrong. The CM is not involved in the HRO process. John Stinchin, she's saying, are relying on misinformation. Ask John if he will help the city of Jacksonville pass its own HRO. And that's from your opponent, Maria Mark, weighing in on social media.
Okay, so let's address the city manager comment first. My understanding of the ordinance from reading the whole thing is that when a complaint is filed, the city manager is the first person to review and decide or determine if there is actually a case. If he determines that there is a case, he hands it off to a magistrate. What that does is you got two parties there that are very very opposed with each other, and no matter what his decision is, one of the parties is going to be upset. So he is in the process according to the ordinance as written. Help Jacksonville pass an HRO ordinance as a city commissioner? I think I go back to my statement. We should have ordinances that do not allow discrimination or mistreatment to anyone for any reason.
Let's take one more call. It's Bob in St. Augustine. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hello. I'd like to ask a question regarding conservation. Water shortages in Florida are becoming more and more of an issue, as everyone knows. Already in South Florida, we're pumping a lot of water down there, and it's already up at Orlando, where we're looking at the issue of St. John's River being tapped into to feed Orlando, and that is a problem that's going to continually just move north as population continues to increase. Rick Scott has pushed forward mandates for insurance companies to be allowed to ask for sinkhole insurance for areas where sinkholes are prevalent, which is really just a problem of the aquifer depleting. But he hasn't addressed issues that could work with that or remediate that problem, such as water conservation measures within the building language, such as rainwater harvesting and graywater recycling. And, you know, as a person that builds and studies sustainability, I mean, you start off by just enacting those measures. You start off by decreasing water consumption by 50%. That's where you start, by enacting things like rainwater harvesting and graywater recycling, which is a huge impact in terms of the water consumption in Florida. But it's going to require legislation in each county for that to happen, to make it happen within the new buildings that are occurring. I'm wondering how you feel about that subject.
All right. Thank you, Bob.
Okay, Bob, good question, because it's my opinion that in the future, water is going to become the most valuable resource that we as a state or a nation have. I've seen water disputes between the state of Texas and New Mexico, in which Texas made claim to water that originated in the state of New Mexico, and they actually won their case. So these battles are going to spread across the country as water becomes more and more scarce. So, yeah, I think anything we can do, coming from the desert, we didn't have surface water. So you've got rainwater collection, stormwater collection, graywater recycling and purification. Those are all great ways to preserve the resource of the water, because 10, 15, 20 years from now, who knows how scarce it's going to be.
And let's close by pointing out that you and all of the other candidates running for office in Atlantic Beach will be at a special forum today, 3 o'clock at Fleet Landing. For those that might want to come and meet you and the others in person, that's a good opportunity.
Absolutely. I think it's, Melissa, it's closed to just a Fleet Landing personnel, sorry.
Oh, it is.
Yeah,
not open
Fleet
to
Landing
the public.
Residents, yeah. No.
But
not open.
Go to your website, as you said, for other town halls coming up, and the primary election is right around the corner, August 25th.
Correct.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
We were joined by candidate John Stinson. Several races up for grabs this month out in Atlantic Beach. Later, best-selling author Andrew Moranis will talk to him about his book, Strong Inside, a fascinating look at race and college sports in the South. But up next, strengthening Florida's agricultural communities. That's in our Going Green. We're back in a moment.
This broadcast of the Florida Times Union.
Every day here at WJCT, volunteers read the Florida Times Union news, obits, op-eds,
and moving on to zits.
They even tickle your funny bone with the comics. Their mission through the radio reading service is to serve people living with blindness and other physical challenges. Need our service? Go online to wjct.org/radio reading. Listen there, or we'll send you a special radio free. Because at Radio Reading, we give voice to the printed word.
What's cooking in the money section, Jane?
Fact or fiction? Do seeds or popcorn exacerbate diverticulitis? What is the best diet? Do vaccines cause autism? And does duct tape really cure warts? The Medical Mythbusters session will answer these questions and more. Join us at our annual health conference, Girls Day Out, Saturday, August 15th, Hyatt Hotel. Tickets are only $40. More information at wjct.org/Baptist, good for you, or call 904-549-2938.
You know, foreign investment is usually a good thing. Usually.
These are foreign investors, these are money launderers, these are South American drug dealers hiding their money in London.
And then sometimes it's not so good. I'm Kai Rizdahl, London Real Estate, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Follow what's happening at WJCT, even when you're away from your radio. You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can listen live online to WJCT-FM at wjct.org/listen, or on iTunes Radio or TuneIn Radio. And you can hear all of your favorite WJCT-FM shows anytime on demand on iTunes and Stitcher. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
Welcome back. Well, in today's fast-paced, urbanized world, we don't always stop to think about a very important aspect of Florida's economy, agriculture. It is a major force around the state. And this weekend, the First Coast Specialty Crop Conference, yes, the Crop Conference, is coming to town to provide practical skills for strengthening our local agriculture community. Tara Freeman, University of Florida's Duval County Small Farms Agent, has a preview for us right now. It's today's Going Green. Hey, Tara, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for this opportunity to be here today.
Thank you for joining us. Now, this is coming up on the 14th and 15th. It's a big event for farmers, our regional food system. This is fascinating. What's going to be happening?
So the conference is actually a three-day event. It will start Thursday evening with a series of on-farm workshops. The first one will be at Frog Song Organics in Hawthorne, Florida. And Friday morning, we will have two on-farm workshops in Duval County. We'll begin at Down to Earth Farm in Jacksonville, where we will tour the farm and learn about how they are building healthy soils using cover crops. Afterwards, we will go to University of North Florida Ogier Gardens, and we will tour their agroecological gardens.
Tell us about that. What is an agroecological garden?
Oh, that is a garden that incorporates various elements of sustainability into the program, such as using rainwater collection, compost, a socially just food system, the education of students. And then on Saturday is the actual conference, which will take place at UNF Student Union. It will begin from 8 to 4:30. And this is actually an adaptation of a small farms and alternative enterprise conference that has taken place for the past 6 years in Kissimmee, Florida. We have adapted it to a regional scale. So this conference speaks to farmers and other stakeholders in the Northeast Florida food system.
Mm-hmm. And so sustainability is a watchword in so many industries now, and that includes agriculture. It's come to agriculture in a big way, hasn't it?
Correct. And sustainability incorporates ecological sustainability, as well as financial sustainability for the farms. So our goal is to educate about practical methods for farm sustainability.
What are some of the ideas that will be discussed that some of the business people can learn about?
We are going to have four tracks of workshops going on simultaneously. So you will be able to pick new sessions that speak to you, such as building healthy soils, diversifying your farm. You will have an opportunity to learn about microgreen production and marketing, cut flower production and marketing, mushroom production and marketing. We will have a session on post-harvest handling and cooling of specialty crops, selecting suitable vegetable crops and varieties for Northeast Florida, sustainable weed suppression, controlling weeds with steel and other methods. We'll also have
controlling weeds with steel?
Yes. It's an innovative idea. Well, actually, one of the first farm tour at Frog Song Organics is going to have a hands-on display of how to suppress weeds with steel. And then they'll be back for the session to educate in more detail about how to suppress weeds with steel.
Oh my! And so how does that work? We don't know yet how that works. We will learn how that works on Saturday or on Friday. And so this is a large, diverse state. And what goes on agriculturally in North Florida, isn't it? It's different than Central Florida, the Panhandle, South Florida. The community here in our corner of the state is this really specific one. So this is a good opportunity for them, isn't it?
Absolutely. This is an opportunity for anyone interested in working in the farming community or the local food system in Northeast Florida. Actually, Duval County, according to the USDA 2012 Census of Agriculture, has 352 farm operations with an average of 80 acres each. The Duval County Agricultural and Natural Resource Industries contribute over 8 $1 billion annually to Jacksonville's economy.
Wow. It is a major economic driver for our area. Again, it's the First Coast Specialty Crop Conference. Register at firstcoastconference.eventbrite.com. And Tara Freeman with our local extension office, thanks for sharing this with us. Fascinating stuff.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share the conference.
And we're back in a moment.
This Going Green segment brought to you by Bug Out Service. If you love All Things Considered, consider joining us a few hours early for Afternoons on WJCT. The Takeaway offers a fresh way to look at the news, featuring critical conversations, reports from the field, and listener participation. That's followed by The World, with engaging voices to illuminate what's going on around the globe and why it matters to you. It's the smart way to spend your afternoons. Weekdays from 2 to 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to announce that Mary Enworth will be this year's morning keynote speaker at Teach. Mary is co-author of Pathways to the Common Core. She is deputy director of middle schools at the Teachers Reading and Writing Project, Columbia University. Mary is just one of the many great speakers you will hear throughout the day. For more information or to purchase tickets, go to WJCT/teach.
So I go home and I tell my mother, and I say, Ma, I'm not going to be a doctor. I'm going to work to clean up hazardous waste. I'm going to be an engineer. My grandmother said, baby, why do you want to work on a train?
Join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour, true stories told live from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Saturdays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, many of us are familiar with the big stories of racial integration in sports, like Jackie Robinson with the Dodgers or Althea Gibson at Wimbledon. But after the 1964 Civil Rights Act became law, many lesser-known athletes who were African-American became firsts, whether they wanted to or not. One of them was a guy named Perry Wallace. Wallace, who began playing basketball for Vanderbilt in 1967, was the first African-American player on the basketball court in the SEC. Now, even before he accepted a scholarship to Vandy, Wallace received death threats from people who didn't want him playing. But by the time he was a senior, Wallace was actually voted the university's most popular student. Today, he is a law professor at American University, and the story of Perry Wallace unfolds in a new best-selling biography by Andrew Moranis. Strong Inside, Perry Wallace and the Collision of Race and Sports in the South. Now, Moranis is doing an appearance at the St. John's Town Center Barnes & Noble store tomorrow, but he joins us today with more about this incredible book. Andrew Moranis, welcome to the program. Pleasure to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. Now, this topic interested you because you were affiliated with Vanderbilt University, and you had the opportunity, I think, as a student to interview Perry Wallace. Is that right?
That's right. So I tell people that it took me 8 years to write this book, but really the story has been on my mind for about 25 years. It was 1989. I was a sophomore at Vanderbilt taking a black history course, and I wrote a paper about Perry Wallace. That was the first time I interviewed him. And it's probably the one thing I remember from the classroom in college. You know, it stayed on my mind for years, and it was the most interesting story I had ever heard that had never been told in a book form. And so I said, if I know this story, I should write it. You know, and so 8 years ago, I set out to write this biography.
Right, and because Perry Wallace hasn't been a household name, even though he was the first black player to play college basketball, and when he started in 1967, there are some searing accounts of what Wallace went through particularly in the away games. Can you tell us about what he shared with you?
Sure. And you mentioned Jackie Robinson in the intro, and I think of Perry Wallace as a figure of an equal caliber to Jackie Robinson. In many ways, what he went through, because of where he was doing it and when he was doing it, the Deep South of the late 60s, was just as dangerous as anything that Jackie Robinson went through. So and in some cases, it was what he didn't go through that was interesting. University of Mississippi canceled both of its games against Vanderbilt Perry Wallace's freshman year, rather than play against a team that had African-American player. His sophomore year, Perry's the first player to play a game in Oxford at Ole Miss. The first half of the game, he takes an elbow to the face, and he's bleeding from his nose. He can't see out of one eye. The referees do not call a foul. They don't whistle a stop to the game. So it's not until the next dead ball that the trainer and manager are able to walk on the court to assist Perry. And as they walk him across the court, the crowd rises and cheers the fact that he's been injured.
Wow.
Perry told me that as he looked at the team's schedule at the road games, you know, to Tuscaloosa and Auburn and Starkville and Oxford before each season, he looked at it with the deepest sense of dread. And he would imagine, what's the worst thing that could happen on one of these trips? And in his mind, it was to be shot and killed, either out on the basketball court or around town before or after one of these games. Tremendous courage just to get on the plane and play a basketball game.
In fact, you write a lot about just the incredible loneliness of an early pioneer like Wallace. They were out there alone.
That's right, on the basketball court, but also on campus. And what Perry told me is the most difficult thing for him about his experience wasn't the 2 hours twice a week on the basketball court. It was every other hour of every other day, of every other week for these long semesters where, you know, it's basically a segregated Greek system on the Vanderbilt campus, and this entire social scene revolved around these fraternities and sororities that were not integrated. There was very little for the African-American students to do on campus. They would be ignored by their professors in class, have doors slammed in their face as they walked down a dormitory hallway. And he said it was that sense of isolation and loneliness that was the most difficult thing to deal with.
There's one quote that stands out where Wallace told you that at an away game, he can't forget this image of what looked like three generations of one family, and all of them were spitting at him, screaming at him, and threatening him.
That's right. I believe that was his first game at Mississippi State, and that was the type of thing that he encountered over and over again on the basketball court. And one of the things that was a little bit counterintuitive about his experience as a basketball player in the SEC, you know, which is still really known as a football conference, but especially so back then in the 60s, is these were small arenas that in many cases were agsters, you know, and you'd have just a couple hundred or a few thousand people there. He could hear everything that was being directed him. The fans were right on the court. His mom, who is dying of cancer while he's going through his college career, listening to games on the radio back in Nashville, could hear everything that was being said and directed at her son, as opposed to an arena maybe where there's 20,000 people screaming, you can't hear any individual's voice.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting, too, is sort of the coda to his college career was at his last game, which he performed brilliantly at, he did a move that was illegal at the time, a slam dunk. Now, today, when you think of basketball, you can't think of basketball without players showing off with a slam dunk. But he was breaking the rules when he did that. And wasn't a law passed in the college world to ban the slam dunk because so many black players were so good at it?
That's absolutely right. So your younger listeners probably won't remember, or they won't know, that the slam dunk was banned for about 10 years in college basketball, just as Perry Wallace was coming along, just as players like Lew Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, were out at UCLA, changing the way the game was being played.
Right.
And so in Perry's last game, he dedicates it to his mom, who has passed away before his senior season. The last basket of his college career is an illegal slam dunk. And he said this was much more important than just 2 points in a basketball game. It was incredibly symbolic. And he said, and growing up in segregated Nashville, there are these segregation laws that were laws, but they were unjust laws. And playing college basketball, there was the no-dunk rule, which was a rule, but it was an unjust rule. And so this was his form of protest on the way out.
Yeah, it was his final statement.
That's right.
He went on to become a law professor at American University.
Yeah, Perry's had an incredibly successful career post-basketball. He was drafted by the Philadelphia 76ers, played 1 year of minor league basketball, then went to Columbia University Law School, Ivy League Law School, was an attorney for the U.S. Justice Department for many years. And for the last 20 years, he's been a professor of law at American University. You walk into his office in D.C. today, There's not a single trophy or sports action shot or jersey. You would never know this history that he made on the basketball court.
And why is that? Why do you think he has downplayed that so much? Because it's been a painful legacy in some respects?
In some respects, you know, I think a picture of himself in a Vanderbilt uniform playing a game maybe in Oxford, Mississippi isn't something he wants to look at every day. But more so than that, I think that, you know, he's a well-rounded person. He's a sort of a Renaissance man. He sings opera as well. I think he wants to be taken seriously as a law professor. He's trying to disprove stereotypes all the time. I don't think he wants people walking in to the office of a 6'5" African-American, and the first question is, did you play basketball?
Huh.
You know, he's an attorney, he's a lawyer, he's a professor, and that's what he's proud of today.
Now, for you, this process must have been an interesting one as well. You are, we didn't want to lead with this, but you are the son of Pulitzer Prize-winning author David Moranis. Now you're out with a best-selling book. I'm sure your father's proud. You're continuing in your family's legacy.
Yeah, that's been a lot of fun. I grew up around writing and writers my whole life. I knew this was something that I wanted to try. A little bit of pressure to try to live up to some high bar.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
You know, but it's been a lot of fun. My parents have been incredibly supportive of the book. We're down here on vacation, actually, in Amelia Island. I don't know that they're going to be supportive in terms of coming out to the bookstore tomorrow. Everybody would rather hang out on the beach. So
yeah.
Hopefully some of your listeners will come out to the Barnes & Noble tomorrow. But yeah, it's been, I'm very fortunate to have a great role model in my father as a writer.
Now, what's Vanderbilt's reaction to this book been like?
It's been tremendous. Perry Wallace and I have spoken in Nashville several times with great crowds. Vanderbilt published the book. It's Vanderbilt University Press that published it. The relationship between Perry and the university has improved tremendously over the last 10 or 15 years. I know that the chancellor, just a couple weeks ago, called Perry Wallace. They spoke for about an hour about the chancellor's respect for Perry and what he did and his desire to involve him even more deeply in the sort of the day-to-day operations of the school, have him come back from Washington to speak to students and to have a presence at the university. It's been really nice to see that.
I would think, too, for young athletes, hearing his story has got to be somewhat mind-blowing because college sports is a different world today.
It sure is a different world. And I think when I've heard Perry speak to college or high school athletes, you know, he'll talk a little bit about basketball, but mostly what he talks about is off the court. You know, in Perry, I think, you know, he was a double major in engineering, math, and electrical engineering. Like I said, he went to law school. He's an attorney, professor. He used basketball as a means to an end. And I think that he sees too many young people with all of their hopes pinned on professional sports. And, you know, that's not a very likely aspiration for most people.
Sure. Well, it's so fascinating to speak with you. And this is just a window into your appearance tomorrow night at the Barnes & Noble at the St. John's Town Center, 7 o'clock tomorrow night, a chance to meet you and get a book signed and learn more about this.
That's right. I love talking about the book and be happy to talk to people there at the bookstore and sign their books. I hope we'll have a nice turnout.
Yeah, that's tomorrow night. Come on out and meet New York Times bestselling author Andrew Moranis. He will sign copies of his book, fascinating book, Strong Inside, Perry Wallace and the Collision of Race and Sports in the South. Again, that's tomorrow night, 7 o'clock at the Town Center. Andrew, a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me. It was fun.
And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And next on Diane Rehm, the espionage trial of Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian has ended in Tehran. Rezaian could face years in prison. Coming up, a look at the Iranian judicial system and what the verdict might mean for U.S.-Iranian relations. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day. We'll be right back.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.